Welcome to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg on a Thursday. Coming up today, we're talking about why we lie and the thrill of it. Call us. We want to hear about your worst lies. The number is 888-477-9499. Or you can email studio2@whyy.org.
As a certain singer-songwriter once said, faker's gonna fake, Cherry. We will dig into that later in the hour. Also, after that, it's Trivia Thursday here at Studio 2, so stay tuned.
Yeah, for sure. And at the top of the show, we're going to talk about the upcoming judicial elections here in the Commonwealth. In case you didn't know, yes, there are some that we need to pay attention to.
Absolutely. But first, let's dig into our top news stories today. Cherry, wanted to start with a different election, the mayoral election. No secret and no surprise, it's been very, very expensive here in Philadelphia. One of the things driving the cost of this particular campaign is PAC spending. $7 million in PAC spending contributed to the mayoral election here in Philadelphia. Mayor Rindy over at WHYY's Billy Penn took a look at who is funding those PACs, really dug into the sources that we know. Some of the PAC spending, we don't really know who's behind it, and so it's a convoluted scene. I probably shouldn't summarize all of it here because I want to be fair, but I just want to direct you to that story at BillyPenn.com and say if you're interested in who is behind the PAC spending in this race and what that might illuminate about where the candidates stand, I really do recommend this article.
Yeah, well, what makes me nervous about this and the whole idea of PAC spending, Avi, is that individual contributions into these PACs, I mean, you have billionaires giving up over $700,000 and half a million, you know, $500,000. That's a lot of money and a lot of influence over voters. And the average person has no idea who is sending these messages to them. It's, you know, while we do what we do and while we had all the mayoral candidates in and talk to them. And that's why you as an individual voter has to do your research. And stand independently on your vote.
Yeah. And you'll see in this article, it's not just the mayor's race, too.
Yeah,
the city council
city council
as well. There's some big spending going on. And on some level, you could argue that's more troubling because in those really crowded fields where name recognition matters a lot, getting a big injection of cash from a PAC can really propel a candidate. You know, in the mayor's race, there's more money sloshing around, so it gets a little muddier. Not that the PAC money doesn't help, but it's just like a little more muddied. But with these city council races at large, you know, a field with three dozen candidates and a PAC picks one or two people to spend a lot of money on, you can imagine that makes a humongous difference.
Humongous difference, seriously. And it makes it hard to run if you don't have that kind of money.
Absolutely.
So staying in Philadelphia, this Saturday will mark the 38th anniversary of the tragic police bombing of the MOVE headquarters in Cobbs Creek. That day, May 13th, 1985, 11 MOVE members were killed. 61 homes burned to the ground. But this anniversary of the MOVE bombing, Avi, is a turning point. There's a new push to, quote, reclaim Osage.
Reclaim Osage.
Yeah. Okay. Why? Well, of the 61 homes destroyed, only one was never returned to the owners, and that's 6221 Osage Avenue. That was the MOVE headquarters, and MOVE, of course, was a radical back-to-nature type of group. Mm-hmm. But the house was owned by Louise James. She was the sister of the founder of MOVE. His name was John Africa. She was not in the house when it was bombed, but her home had been taken by eminent domain. It was eventually used as a police substation, and a few years ago, it was sold to a developer, and that developer turned it into a home and sold it to a private person.
Oh, interesting.
But now the house was getting so much attention by reporters and others that the owner wanted to sell it, called up MOVE member Mike Africa Jr., told him they wanted to sell it to him, and I spoke to him this week, and here's what he had to say.
My aunt's dying wish, Louise James's dying wish, was to get her house back. She says 6221 Osage Avenue is my house. I bought it. I raised my family here. I want it back. It belongs to my family, not the city's. And I am her great nephew, and I'm getting it back.
And so tomorrow at 10 a.m. outside of that house, they're going to launch Reclaim Osage, and they're buying the house. So it'll be back in the
ownership.
Is
there an idea of what they would do with it after buying it? Besides fulfilling, I guess, the wish of the aunt.
Not at this point. I think they're going to turn it into some kind of memorial, possibly. Mike said he will not be living there, but they want to have it back in the MOVE family.
Interesting. Well, we'll keep our eye on that. Going now from West Philadelphia to South Philadelphia, where things will be very, very busy this weekend, Cherry. You might have heard the Taylor Swift is in town. Three dates starting tomorrow. This is part of her big Eras tour. It's not cheap to go. I believe if you're on the secondary market right now, it's like $1,200 per ticket at the cheapest. She's going to be playing the Link, so huge crowds, lots of traffic. I don't know. Do we really need to tell people who Taylor Swift is? She's a singer-songwriter. She's from Reading.
The Swifties are giving you the side of right now.
She's,
no,
she's
you
like
do
the
not
biggest
have
pop
to tell
star in the
us.
World. But it's a big deal. You know, there's a lot of excitement. She has not gone on tour in a long, long time, so ergo she's not been to Philadelphia in a long, long time. And so it's a huge deal for her fans, and frankly it's a big deal for the city. I don't want to downplay it at all.
No, it's a big deal. I love Swifties, right? They're very powerful. They had Ticketmaster shaking and they're quaking in their boots. But I should mention that with 3 days of Eras tour at the Link, with the Sixers game and
tonight,
all
yeah.
that, you know, political figures stumping for mayoral candidates, I mean, it's going to be a lot of traffic. So brace yourself.
Crazy few days, because you mentioned those political figures. So Bernie Sanders and AOC are going to be in town for the mayoral election. Then on Monday.
And there's rallies for others, too. Like, it's a lot.
And then Monday, I believe, is Penn commencement. And Joe Biden is going to be there because his granddaughter is graduating. So just it is Philly is, as always, the center of the universe.
Yeah, and you can listen to WHO. I will keep you company. How about that?
All right. Now let's get to our newsmaker segment. And I'll write your name. You might have a few blank spaces on your theoretical primary ballot because there's a lot going on. The primary's just days away. It's this Tuesday. And we want to turn to Pennsylvania's judicial elections, which often get overlooked by voters. But they really matter in this election. There's a lot on the line, including the fight for a vacant Supreme Court seat, and it's turning into a costly fight.
Yeah, and while judges aren't supposed to be overtly political, voters can infer a lot from the groups funding their campaigns. And here to tell us about the judicial races and what is at stake is Deborah Gross, CEO and president of Pennsylvanians for a Modern Court. It's a nonpartisan judicial watchdog group working to educate Pennsylvania voters. Welcome to Studio 2, Debbie.
Thank you very much.
So I want to jump in because a lot of folks may not realize this, but there are a few big statewide judicial races. I want you to first explain how judges are elected in the Commonwealth.
So in Pennsylvania, in odd-numbered years, we elect our judges. We have right now one seat available for the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, two seats for the Pennsylvania Superior Court, one seat for the Pennsylvania Commonwealth Court. These are our appellate courts. These are our highest courts that make rulings and decisions which impact most people's everyday lives. For example, the Commonwealth Court recently issued a decision on whether the funding for education in Pennsylvania was constitutional. So it is very important for people to go out and vote. There are also ballots. There are also other positions, other judicial positions on the ballot for Court of Common Pleas, magisterial district judges, so you should go out and be informed about your ballot.
And so the Supreme Court, tell us about this one vacancy, how the seat became vacant, and what the race is looking like. It does seem like there's some money being spent there.
I'd like to say there's some money, but not as much money yet as in the past.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So
that seems to buck the trend a little bit with these races.
Yeah. But I anticipate for the general, we'll see more money.
Okay.
So there's two Democratic contenders and two Republican contenders at the moment. The Supreme Court, there is a seat vacant because the former Chief Justice of Pennsylvania, Max Baer, unfortunately passed away in October. But his seat would have become vacant because he was hitting the retirement age of 75 in December. So we all knew that there would be one seat open.
And the partisan breakdown of the court right now, remind folks and sort of what this election could or could not do.
So the election wouldn't change the balance.
Yep.
Because right now, I hesitate to answer a partisan breakdown because judges are, once they are elected, right, should be independent. The independence of our judiciary is of utmost importance to the confidence of our citizens. So it does have a Democratic majority at the moment.
Of people who ran as Democrats.
Correct.
On the ballot. Okay.
Correct.
Yeah. And so let's dig in because I think most people have no idea how to decide or determine whether or not a candidate would make a good judge. But there's some tools and some folks who've done the work. Tell us where you can get information to sort of vet these folks, because there's a lot of names you probably never heard of.
So there are very thorough investigations done by various bar associations, the Pennsylvania Bar Association, the Philadelphia Bar Association, Montgomery County. But you can find out all this information on PMC's website, www.pmconline.org, where we list the courts, the candidates, as well as these investigations and recommendations that the bar associations do.
And they do a pretty extensive, and tell the, you know, just the types of things that they look at when vetting these candidates.
So I am a former chancellor of the Philadelphia Bar Association, and I participated in the Philadelphia Bar Association's Judicial Selection Commission, and it's a very thorough investigation. It is done by lawyers and non-lawyers. We do not look at the registration of those in the committee, and we thoroughly investigate. We ask opponents of these candidates what they thought of this candidate, you know, in court. We read their briefs. We ask judges. We want to make sure that the candidates have had a number of years of practice. There are questions about their financial and financial or administrative abilities. You know, interestingly, the candidates for the Pennsylvania Supreme Court are all prior judges, or all current judges, I'll say, for other courts. So they have the judicial expertise, but you can look into their decisions. You can look into their experiences of what types of judges they are to help you decide as well.
Yeah.
So I wanted to circle back to something you mentioned earlier, this idea that a judge runs as part of a party in a primary, and then is supposed to be impartial once they sit on the bench. How does that work, and does that work?
So I believe it does work because I know these judges. So, you know, once they take the bench, they can't make promises that they're going to rule a certain way on issues. In fact, they are not even allowed to answer questions about certain issues. Mm. So you don't know how they'll run. And unfortunately, in Pennsylvania, we elect our judges, so they need to have a party. But there are many who, once they take the bench, actually have issued decisions, I'll say, that would be unexpected.
Interesting.
Yeah, and I want to dig into that because we hear our Supreme Court now is under fire. People are looking at whether or not they can trust it. We have about a minute or so left. Can you talk about the trust and the appearance of unbiasedness that the court must hold?
So it's really important. Our Pennsylvania judges, most of our judges other than the U.S. Supreme Court, have a code of conduct and have, you know, judicial ethics commissions that oversee them. We don't have that in the U.S. Supreme Court. It's the only court that unfortunately doesn't have a code of conduct. But here, you know, there are the Pennsylvania Supreme Court has a code of conduct. Supreme Court judges have a code of conduct by which they have to operate. And it even goes into restrictions as to what they can do as candidates, how they can raise money. They cannot ask. A judicial candidate cannot ask someone for money. They cannot accept a check. They cannot accept an envelope. They have a campaign committee that is responsible for doing that.
Well, that is Deborah Gross, president of Pennsylvanians for a Modern Court. Deborah, thanks so much for being with us here today on Studio 2.
Thank you.
And remember to vote, folks. That is a big thing coming up in this primary, those judicial elections.
Absolutely. And the countdown is on. And coming up next on Studio 2, lies and the liars who tell them. We want to hear from you, 888-477-9499 or email studio2.org.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Tell me lies, tell me sweet little lies. Tell me lies.
Very musical day.
I did.
Today on Studio 2. That, of course, is the 1987 song Little Lies by Fleetwood Mac, and you are listening to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Have you been following the George Santos case and the long list of lies that the first-term New York representative is accused of? Well, yesterday, the 13-count indictment was unsealed, and it included money laundering, wire fraud, lying on federal disclosure forms, and stealing public funds. Santos has pleaded not guilty this morning.
But what's also strange is that on top of all those criminal charges, Santos told countless lies about his background and resume. Mm. For instance, that he was a star volleyball player, graduated from Baruch College in NYU, worked on Wall Street, that his mom was in the South Tower during 9/11, that his grandparents were Jewish Holocaust survivors.
Avi, I'm giving the side eye because it is mind-boggling that someone would make up all of this and think they could get away with it. Of course, we all lie like a little bit, but why do some people lie so much? We want to dig into this more with someone who studies deception and why we do it. Joining us is Maurice Schweitzer, a professor at the Wharton School. Welcome to Studio 2.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And you can join our conversation with your truthful statements. Call us. Call us with your comments and questions about lying. What's the worst lie, for instance, someone told you? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email address is studio2@whyy.org.
And so, Maurice, we want to start by laying the foundation. Let's define lie, because there's levels to this, you know, from little white lie to all out fraud and deceit. And some are more acceptable than others. Give us the layers of this.
Well, yeah, first, I define deception as a misrepresentation that's intentional of a truthful either feeling or fact. So I might tell you I'm really happy to be here. And then,
but you're miserable.
Yeah, well, I'm super uncomfortable. I'm really happy to see you, or yeah, I'd love for you to join me for lunch. So we might lie about both emotions and facts. We can lie about intentions. We start off learning to lie from a very young age, and it's really a developmental milestone when our kids at ages 3 and 4 start to tell lies, where they realize that what they know might be different from what other people know. So they might say, oh, I haven't had a cookie yet, or I already washed my hair, trying to figure out if they might get another cookie, or maybe they don't have to get a bucket of water dumped on their head. And they learn and navigate their social world where they're getting a lot of feedback. So we get this quick, clear feedback. That's what we need to learn. So a young child who says, oh, I haven't had a cookie yet, and a parent says, oh, I see crumbs on your face. Hmm. And they realize, like, oh, the physical evidence is giving me away. And then that night when they say, oh, I already washed my hair, and then the parent pushes, you know, rubs their head and said, oh, your head's totally dry.
Yeah.
Here's a bucket of water. And again, they're like, oh, physical evidence. And we begin to get better at lying. So we lie about all kinds of things.
Yeah.
Is there a most common type of lie? Let's look just at adults, so not kids who are learning how to lie. Do we have a way of quantifying, or maybe just anecdotally guessing, what the most common types of lies are and how frequently those lies are uttered?
Yeah, we know that people lie all the time. It's constant. People embellish things about themselves. There's a lot of self-enhancement. Men are more likely than women to engage in self-enhancement. Hmm. Women are more likely to engage in pro-social lies that make other people feel better. So, oh, I love your haircut, or, you know, you look great in that outfit. We'll tell lies to make other people feel better. And sometimes we're engaged in deception that actually sort of might help us out at the same time. So you can imagine a couple, the husband's really eager to get out, and the wife's like, oh, do I look okay in this dress? And he's like, well, oh, no, you look fantastic. Let's just go.
Right.
And so it could be both.
And I want to just, for those of you who are just tuning in, we are speaking with Maurice Schweitzer, a professor at the Wharton School, whose expertise is the psychology of lies and deceit. We want to hear from you. The number is 888 888- 877-947-9499, and you can email studio2@whyy.org. I want to piggyback on what you were just talking about, Maurice, because we got an email from Kenneth who says, people lie to avoid potentially negative fallout that we believe may result from telling the truth. If it's your best friend's birthday and she bought a dress that she loves, you will tell her she looks great no matter what to avoid ruining her night.
That's a pro-social lie.
That's a pro-social lie that you're talking about.
Exactly.
Yeah, and so there, can we go over some of the many reasons that people lie and that are, quote, acceptable in our culture?
So pro-social lies happen all the time, but as I was suggesting before, sometimes we use them for self-serving reasons too. So maybe I want to smooth over this relationship, or I want to kick the can down the road and not talk about something right now. But one key issue to think about is, to what extent could somebody change? So imagine there's a bride on her wedding day and she says, oh, how do I look in my dress? Well, there's a right answer for that question, no matter how she looks.
Yeah. You look great.
You look fantastic.
Yeah.
And if it's 3 months before, where that same bride's like, hey, I'm picking out dresses, how do I look in this dress? Well, that now the answer could be different,
mm-hmm.
Because you have time to change something. Or you can think about feedback for a presentation. Is there time to change? Would that candid feedback be really helpful? Or is there not much opportunity for that honest statement to help somebody?
I actually want to get into that, because this is a quote you told Time magazine in 2018, and I think it gets at what you're talking about. You said, I believe that we should be teaching our kids, students, and employees when and how to lie. So right. Basically trying to determine, if you're being altruistic, when should you lie and when should you tell the truth? So how do we do that? How do we teach people how to lie?
Well, you know, here's what we do now. So what we do now is we tell our kids never lie, or we have mission statements in companies that talk about honesty and truth. And then we take people in customer service, or we take our kids. And so we take our kids to grandparents and say, oh, you know, tell grandma you love the sweater, or, you know, tell her that you love the soup. Or hey, somebody's, you know, sort of calling you. Yeah, tell them that you're not feeling well, and that's why, you know, you can't have a play date with somebody you don't like. So we tell them never lie, and then we guide them, okay, here are a bunch of lies that I want you to tell.
Mm-hmm. That seems like mixed messaging.
Yeah. Which is mixed messaging, and we leave it as an exercise for the young child to kind of figure it out.
Yeah.
Or in a company, we're like, yeah, truth is extremely important. And then we tell people, well, in marketing, you know, here's what we do, or here's the way we, you know, sell products. But not all of it is completely candid. We're not revealing all of the information. And there are norms in different contexts. So you can think about in negotiations or in sales or recommendation letters or, you know, political campaigns. There's gray areas where we're expecting people to exaggerate or omit some information. We're expecting some self-enhancement in some cases. But there are degrees of this. And so what I'm suggesting is that we think about, okay, what are the bright lines?
Mm.
And we can distinguish among types of deception.
Mm.
So lies about material facts can be quite harmful. And they, in some cases, can constitute fraud. Lies about intentions are different. Lies about our feelings are different still. And so we might misrepresent our emotions. And we typically see those lies, particularly when we're down-regulating anger or up-regulating happiness. So we're expressing more happiness than we really feel.
So instead of thou shalt not lie, maybe a more nuanced message as we raise our kids and as we talk to our employees.
I think that's exactly right. There's, yeah. I think for us to be canon, for us to be thoughtful about this, yeah, when we teach our kids, hey, look, here are pro-social lies. We might lie to make people feel better. Here here's where we do that and here's where we don't do that.
And I want to say I've never been a good liar, you know, because I think I just reveal it so easily. I was raised to just tell the truth, tell the truth, tell the truth. And so I want to bring in a caller here who Claire is online. She has a question about detecting lies. And I always feel like I can be, you could see the lie on my face. So I want Claire to ask her question. Claire, you're on Studio 2. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. Can you hear me? I'm not sure if I...
We can.
Okay, great, great. My father was a master embellisher, and I come from a big family with lots of siblings. And some of us siblings were able to detect it and have made an effort to not be like my father because he would lie for no reason. It wasn't necessary. Others have continued on with the tradition and are lying out the wazoo. How? And I can detect it in them, and they're not even aware. How does one become a detector and a non-detector?
Yeah, well, let me...
That's interesting.
That's interesting. The lie out the wazoo.
Super fantastic. So let me start by saying there are, as Cherry was saying, two types of people broadly. Mm-hmm. Some people, like Cherry, that don't lie, and so you're not going to get very good at it. Mm-hmm. And you're probably very anxious when you do it.
So sweating.
Cherry was like, oh, my God, I got to call in sick on Monday. Let me practice my cough. You know, let me see how I do. And she's like, you know, oh, my God, it was terrible. They, you know, I can't believe, you know, like she's like in cold sweat, you know, calling in sick. For other people, that's, you know, calling in sick, that's just like Tuesday. Like no problem. People do it all the time. Like, and sometimes they begin to overdo it, sort of lying about things they don't even need to lie about.
Yeah.
And you can lose credibility as people learn that that's what's happening. Now, lie detection is hard. Mm. Lie detection is hard because we tend to get better feedback. I talked about this quick, clear feedback that helps us learn. We get better feedback when we tell lies than when we detect lies. Detecting lies, often there's a delay. Sometimes we never learn. So detecting lies is hard. We tend to be overconfident in our ability to detect lies, but sometimes we have a feeling that, hey, something's not quite right. And there we want to probe further and figure things out. When we tell lies, there are a couple things that happen. One is people are more cognitively loaded, as they have more in their minds. They're trying to keep the truth.
It's hard to lie.
It's hard work. Yeah. And we sometimes make mistakes or people go off on long tangents. They add in extra information. So there are tells about what people do. Second, people try to often overdo it. So if I tell you, oh, my daddy's a minister, or I was always told to tell the truth, or let me be honest with you, we're sometimes overdoing it. We're trying to create this impression we're super honest.
Yeah.
And it's weird. Like, why would you say that?
Doth protest too much, in a sense.
Exactly. Like,
yeah. Actually, so I think we're getting a little pushback from listeners about this idea of that you should teach people to lie. And I know that's an oversimplification, but I did want to bring in an email from Elizabeth who wrote in and said, I lived with my ex-sister-in-law and her toddler. My son told the truth always, but my sister taught hers to lie. And I remember when her child lied, I watched the shock on my son's face and the realization came over him that he didn't have to tell the truth either 40 years ago, and this still upsets me. I got to imagine there are some bad ways to teach your kids how to lie. So maybe could we add a little nuance to your point about nuance? If we are going to sort of tell kids it's okay to lie in some circumstances, how do we do it in a way that doesn't, you know, corrupt them?
Yeah, so I think the key idea here is to make a clear distinction where if there's no way to help people in the future, so, you know, like this is sort of this extreme case of the bride on her wedding day, how do I look? Or somebody that's just got a haircut, you know, what do you think of my haircut? We can think about, here's some cases where we can make people feel better, or we could avoid saying things altogether, where we just don't comment on things. Where I think the point that I sort of, you know, want to make here is that when we send mixed messages, we're telling kids never lie. And then we either lie ourselves or we guide our kids to lie about how much they liked grandma's meatloaf. we're sending a mixed message, and some people are learning that in ways that can get mixed up. And I think, you know, my sort of guess here is that the lie about significant issues, we want to draw a bright line where we say, look, you know, I need to know exactly, you know, what's happening on the math. You know, don't lie to me about whether or not you have a math test. That's material. That's important. We need to have a foundation of trust based on the key pieces of knowledge that are really important.
And I just want to reestablish, we are speaking with Maurice Schweitzer, a professor at the Wharton School, who knows all about the psychology of lies and deceit. You can call us. What was the worst lie you were told or ever told? Call us 888-477-9499. Again, 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. We have Kate on the line. I'm an honest person. I just don't speak on things if I have something bad to say. And Kate wants to talk about some of that. Kate, you're on Studio 2.
Welcome, Kate.
And provide your comment or question.
I think you're on the right track. I think life is far too complicated already without adding lies to it. I hate the feeling of the slipperiness when you've said something that isn't true. I'd much rather tell someone who says, how do I look in this dress? Oh, I love the bow. Or how do you like grandma's meatloaf? It's a beautiful color. Instead of yuck or oh, wonderful.
That's an interesting take. I mean, so Maurice, can you address that? Are there ways to still be honest but accomplish the same goal as the pro-social lie?
Yeah, so I think, you know, I think in many cases we have options. What I'm suggesting is that we are sometimes not fully candid. So when you say, yeah, I love the bow or I love the color of the meatloaf, you're sending a message too, and we can go too far where we could say, look, I'm just being honest. And I think people sometimes use that as an excuse to be mean. Like, look, the meatloaf is horrible. I'm just being honest. You know, let me just tell you. Yeah. And again, like if there's an opportunity in the future. So if you know this is every Saturday lunch, I'm going over for the meatloaf. There's an opportunity to change. Like, hey, next time, why don't we try chicken? Or why don't we try a big salad? Like, you know, like let's try to mix it up where we can give feedback that would be corrective and helpful going forward. So I'm not saying that we should lie all the time. I'm saying that when we do model deception, we should be more aware and sensitive to the norms of the context. So when it comes to recommendation letters, you don't want someone to write a recommendation letter that is completely factual.
Yeah.
You want it to be, oh, this person had great ideas, lit up the room, that we're expecting some of that to be enhanced.
So I want to bring in Heather now, who's on line 3, who talks about lying to get out of trouble. So this is a slightly different take than what we've heard so far. Heather, you're on Studio 2. What's your comment?
Oh, I was just saying that when I was a kid, I would get in trouble if I told the truth or if I lied, and I felt like I would get in slightly less trouble sometimes when I lied.
Mm.
So it taught me to lie more.
Interesting. Yeah. Interesting. Is that something we see?
Yeah. So, deception can be incredibly useful.
Yeah.
So we sort of start off by suggesting that in the United States, our culture is generally very trusting and very trustworthy. So most of what people say is truthful. So a lot of people like Cherry just don't lie. And there are some people that really hijack that trusting system, that there's so many trusting people out there, and it's easy for some of them, like George Santos, to take advantage of a system that generally trusts what people say.
And I want to bring in, there's a statement that someone made. Adam writes, my very close friend since high school was a compulsive liar. He was very charming and intelligent, but every 2 weeks or so, some large, horrible thing happened to him or his family. I wonder how it had affected me being so close to him for so long and accepting it. And I want to talk quickly about this whole idea of people manufacturing negative things like this this trauma. Like even like George Santos said, you know, my mom survived 9/11. My mm-hmm. grandfather survived the Holocaust. I mean, these types of things are big deals, and people will lie about them to for what?
Well, so here you're going to elicit sympathy.
Yep.
We're going to gain attention. So deception can help us both get some economic rewards and some psychological rewards, where we're gaining sympathy, we're gaining attention. People who cut marathon races, even in amateur races, they just get the accolades, and it's like getting more likes on your posts. People like the psychological rewards that they're getting. They sometimes like that attention. And in George Santos's case, here he lied so much. I think what's interesting is how trusting the system was. That is, he said things that now looking back, like the collection of them is so fanciful. You'd think, who could have believed all this stuff? And yet, you know, in a relatively high-profile campaign for a powerful office, nobody checked.
It's fascinating. So much more to talk about. But such we're out of time, unfortunately. That's Maurice Schweitzer, professor at the Wharton School, who is an expert in lying and deception. Thanks for joining us, Maurice.
Thank you.
Coming up, we've got Studio 2 Trivia. Stay tuned.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
And welcome back to Studio 2. She's Cherry Gregg.
And he is Avi Wolfman Harris.
That is true.
Yes. And this is our weekly Studio 2 Trivia Challenge. Are you ready, Avi?
I'm always ready. I'm born ready.
You stay ready, okay? Mm-hmm. And today's contestant is Amy from Jenkintown. Amy, you're on Studio 2.
Hi.
And since today we've been talking about, we had Taylor Swift, we talked about George Santos, people who we all know. Got to ask you, have you ever been told that you look like somebody famous? And if so, who?
Yes, I get Jennifer Jason Leigh a lot, but I think that is a very flattering comparison.
That's pretty cool. You know who, they say Avi looks like Marky Mark. The Funky Bunch.
Which I don't see at all, by the way. And they
then why are you on the radio?
No, trust me, there's a reason. And Cherry is told that she looks like Regina Hall, which is far closer
from
than
Girls
me. And
Trip.
Hair fluff. Why am I on the radio?
Hair fluff.
All right, Amy, now that you've flattered me, I'm going to ask you a multiple choice question. And if you get it right, you win a WHYY grocery tote bag. And, you know, that's a very coveted prize. Okay. So, are you ready? Are you ready, Amy?
I am ready.
So we mentioned Taylor Swift at the top of the hour. Taylor Swift is a Pennsylvania native. Many know that. And one of her first major singing performances came here in Philadelphia when she was 12 years old. Did she, A, sing the national anthem at a 76ers game, B, play a showcase at the Trocadero, C, sing backup at the Philadelphia Folk Festival, or D, appear on the Nickelodeon program Double Dare? And let me know if you need anything repeated there.
Oh, that's tough. I know she has sung the national anthem as a kid. I'm gonna say the national anthem.
Yeah!
Yes!
Winner, chicken dinner.
Amy,
on a Thursday.
Amy in Jenkintown knows her Taylor Swift origin story.
Yes.
Congratulations, Amy.
Yes, well, I'll be seeing her on Sunday. I can't wait.
Are you serious? And we asked you a question about Taylor Swift. Are you serious?
It was so fortuitous. It's like it was meant to be.
It was meant to be. By the way, the story goes that the Sixers had an employee who babysat for the Swift family in the summer when they vacationed down the shore, and she recommended a young Taylor to sing before a game in 2002.
Oh, look at that. Now she's coming home this weekend.
That's right. I imagine you're pretty excited, Amy.
I am very excited, yes. I didn't think I was ever going to get these tickets, so I'm delighted just to be in that stadium.
Yeah, that's going to be awesome. I wish we could get you the tote bag before you go.
So you can rock it.
But I don't think we're going to get it to you.
And it might not go with your Swiftie outfit, so.
it may not. And also, you're not allowed to bring anything that's not see-through, any bags that aren't see-through.
Oh, yeah, stadium rules.
Well,
I'll put it with pride.
Thank you so much, Amy. We really appreciate you playing. Have a great weekend. And we will get your tote bag to you post haste.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
So every Thursday, we have a brand new question. And if you want to be a winner like Amy, you can participate. Here's what you do. Call. This is a different number than our other number. 215-351-0525. Leave us a message telling us why you'd be a great player, and our producers will call you back if you're selected. Again, the number is 215-351-0525.
Exactly. Now, it's about to be the weekend. WHYY's Tanya Pendleton has our list of things to do.
The weekend beckons with the promise of memories to make, places to go, and people to see. One of those people is Taylor Swift. It's Tay-Tay time in Philly, but if you don't already have tickets to Taylor's three shows at the Link, you'll have to dig deep, and I do mean deep, into your savings. If you still can't afford $1,000 resale tickets, even on a deferred payment plan, because they have those now, we have good news. Swifties can shake off the disappointment at a party for fans at Xfinity Live. The venue is hosting Taygate parties before her shows on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday starting at 2 p.m. And you don't need tickets to the concert, so you can still have a good time to Taylor's music. We'll have all the info on Taygate and other Swift-related parties on our website, whyy.org/things to do. We celebrate Mother's Day on Sunday, and there are some fun options for moms this weekend. It's the music of the Beatles for kids at Brooklyn Bowl, Philadelphia. Lady Madonna. On Saturday, you and the littles can enjoy some classics and celebrate Mother's Day in a special event. Doors open at 11 a.m. and things get started at noon. Evil Genius Beer Company is hosting the Sex in the City Drag Brunch on Sunday starting at 11 a.m. Tickets are sold by the table, so this is one to come to with your besties or whoever you want to celebrate with. Brunch cocktails include Cosmos, of course. One of Philly's most unique events happens on Saturday. It's the Kensington Derby, where people create all manner of moving transportation for a 3-mile race with the infamous mud pit at the end. You can participate on anything that moves as long as it doesn't have a motor. The Derby starts and ends at Trenton and Norris, with judges declaring the ultimate winner. There's an arts festival, too, and live music. Everything kicks off at noon. When the world's gone mad, I'm feeling sad, so why? I'm feeling glad when I... Port Richmond's Pierogi Fest is also on Saturday. It's a celebration of the dumplings popular among the Polish community who lived in the area since the 1700s. More than 20 pierogi vendors and over 100 artists and craftspeople will be on hand, along with live bands and activities for the kids. It's at Thompson and Indiana Streets from noon to 6 p.m.
Bring it on, it's time to play. Has the microphone been tested? Yeah. What about the stand? Yeah. Please.
Class is in session for the School of Rock, opening at South Jersey's Ritz Theater on Friday night. The musical, based on the hit movie, follows down-on-his-luck rocker Dewey Finn, who turns a group of kids into fledgling rock stars. If you do go, you'll have the chance to join a raffle to win a kid-size Mitchell MM100 mini double cutaway electric guitar autographed by the cast. Sounds like a good start to your own band. There's a man coming to town who knows all about making a great living from music.
Did you know that when it snows, my eyes become a lot and the light that you shine can't be seen?
Seal is coming to the Met Philadelphia tonight on his 2023 World Tour, and he's bringing the Buggles with him. The show starts at 7:30. And you can find a rose of your own at Fairmount Park's Love Your Park Week, which celebrates the vast array of parks and green spaces in and around Philadelphia. Volunteers are asked to sign up for cleanup and maintenance effort at their neighborhood or favorite park. Love Your Park Week starts on Saturday and goes through next Sunday, so you can pick a time and a park convenient for you. And let's not forget some roses for the woman who gave us the most precious gift anyone could receive, life. Thanks to my mom and all the mothers out there, whether you're a stepmom, auntie, the neighborhood mom, or a grandmom, we love you. I'm Tanya Pendleton, and we'll be back next Thursday with another Things to Do. You can find details about what you've heard and even more on our website, whyy.org/things to do. Whatever you choose to do, have a great weekend, everyone.
I'll always love my mama.
Shereen.
All right. Happy Mother's Day to all the moms. Got to shout out my mom, Mary Gregg, and to your mom,
Shereen Arendt, and my wife, who's for the first time a
Mother's
mom.
Day,
yeah.
Rosie Dillon. Yeah. Yes, happy Mother's Day to you. Well, that is it for us. For more of our show, you can head on over to whyy.org/studio2, and you can follow WHYY on Twitter. We use the hashtag Studio2.
Our producers are Debbie Builder, our resident Swifty, Paige Murray-Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Our engineer is Charlie Kyer. WHYY's audio general manager is Joan Isabella. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
Who looks like Marky Mark, and I'm Cherry Gregg.
Looks like Regina Hall.
Thank you so much for joining us.